بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. So now we're going to go ahead and get started with the actual prayer itself. So when we begin the salah, the Prophet of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam tells us, تَحْرِيمُهَا التَّكْبِيرُ. The beginning of the prayer, the initiation of the prayer, the entrance into the prayer is التَّكْبِيرُ. To say, Allahu Akbar. That's how we start the prayer. That's how we enter into the prayers, by saying Allahu Akbar. What does Allahu Akbar mean? So first of all, we have Allah, which is the name of Allah. But there's even a discussion about the name of Allah in terms of where it originates from, where it comes from, what it exactly implies and what it means precisely. There are two opinions amongst the scholars about the name of Allah and its origins. One opinion is that the name of Allah is not derived or taken from a root. Rather, it is an original, unique word that is the name of Allah. Ismu Dhat, Lafzul Jalala. The name of the divine, the very magnificent or majestic word. The second opinion is that no, it is derived from a root. It is derived from a root. When discussing what root does it come from, there are three, even four, different opinions that those scholars have. They have a disagreement. There are three or four different possibilities that they present where this word comes from. The first possibility is that this word comes from Allah Ya'lahu, which means to worship. And so therefore Allah is the Al-Ilah, which became Allah, is the one who worships. Is the one who is worshipped. He is the one that we worship. He is the one that is worshipped. The second possibility is it comes from Waliha Yalihu. Waliha Yalihu, which means to be overwhelmed, to be shocked or amazed. And therefore Allah is the one who overwhelms, shocks, He amazes people. Like just the thought of Allah is overwhelming. The third possibility is it comes from Laha Yaluhu, which means to create. Allah is the one who creates. It can also come from Laha Yalihu, which means to be high and hidden from people's eyes. Allah is the one that is exalted and hidden from people's eyes in this world. So these are a few possibilities. My own inclination is that the name of Allah is an original, unique word that is not derived from any of these roots. Rather, it is very commonly found that sometimes, very rarely, the process works in the reverse. A root is derived, a root is created from a word that was already found. And so there's a few reasons for this. Number one, you have this rule in the Arabic language. In etymology, there's this rule. In Arabic, a word is assumed to be jamid. Jamid means original, unique. A word is assumed to be original and unique unless proven otherwise. So if you claim that a word is derived from a root, you have to prove that. You have to establish that fact. And if you cannot prove it, you cannot establish it, then Arabic defaults to the position that then a word is original and unique. That's the default position in the Arabic language. That's number one. So when we look at the opinion of those scholars that say, no, the name of Allah is derived from a root, they are not conclusive. They are not conclusive in regards to where it exactly is coming from. So based off of that, it is the safer, more default position in the Arabic language that the name of Allah is not derived from any root. It is the original, unique word for Allah, for God, the Divine. There's a second thing. Even pronunciation-wise, there's something unique about the name of Allah. In the Arabic language, Lam, is that a light letter or a heavy letter? Lam is a light letter. You can hear it in its pronunciation, Lam. It's a light letter, with the exception of one word. There is only one word, one case in the entire Arabic language where the letter Lam is not light, but it is heavy. And that is the name of Allah. Right? So it's heavy. The fact that the name of Allah has its own unique original pronunciation lends to the fact that the name of Allah is its own original unique word. Number three, grammar-wise. So in the Arabic language, y'all can tell me this. In the Arabic language, when you want to call out to someone, how do you go about in calling out to someone? What do you put in front of their name? Yeah, so if you want to call out to Zaid, you say, Ya Zaid. Ya Zaid, hey Zaid. You put a Ya in front of anyone's name that you're calling out to. That's how it works in Arabic. But there's a rule about using Ya. If the word or the person or the thing that you are calling out to begins with Al, Alif and Lam, then you cannot simply put a Ya. That's why Ar-Rasul An-Nabi. In the Quran, when Allah calls out to the Prophet, addresses the Prophet, He doesn't say, Ya Ar-Rasul, Ya An-Nabi. He says, Ya Ayyuha Ar-Rasul, Ya Ayyuha An-Nabi. That's why we have in the Quran, time and time again, very commonly, Ya Ayyuha Al-Ladhina Amanu. Why is it not Ya Al-Ladhina Amanu? Because Al-Ladhina starts with Alif and Lam. So it cannot be Ya Al-Ladhina Amanu, it has to be Ya Ayyuha. Ayyuha Al-Ladhina Amanu. Like Ya Walad, hey boy. But if I wanted to say the boy, Al Walad, I can't say Ya Al Walad. I have to say Ya Ayyuhal Walad. That's how Arabic works. With one exception. There's only one word that starts with Alif and Lam, but you can put a Ya directly on it. You do not add the phrase Ayyuha, and that is the name of Allah. We don't say Ya Ayyuhallah. We say Ya Allah. Ya Allah. Yes. Right. So, for the pronunciation of that? Right. So those types of adjustments are made in pronunciation to be a little bit more smoother. Like the dhamair, the dhamir goes from lahu to bihi. Who and he have the same exact meaning. There's no reading into the meaning of that. And that's simply an adjustment that's made in sound to make it more consistent. It's called as-suhula ala al-lisan. Tasheela ala al-lisan. And that's basically where it comes from. So we have the fact that a word is assumed to be original, unique, unless proven otherwise. Number two, it's unique pronunciation in the Arabic language that departs from the rest of the language. Number three, grammatically, it's also got something very unique where you can put a ya without adding a yuha. And then there's a fourth thing I'd like to point out here, and that is the word Allahumma. Allahumma. Anyone ever heard that phrase before? When we make dua, Allahumma, right? Allahumma, if you take a look at it, when you separate it, what it actually is Allahu. It's the name of Allah, Allah, with a ma, a meem mushaddada, a meem with a dabya on top of it. All right? That's basically what Allahumma is. It's Allahu ma. So it's just a meem added to the end of the name of Allah. That's all it is. But what does Allahumma mean, everybody? Oh Allah. If Ya Allah is Oh Allah, Allahumma is also Oh Allah. So that tells you that putting a meme at the end of the name of Allah is kind of like similar in meaning to putting a ya in front of the name of Allah. Everybody with me so far? However, when I want to call out to anyone, when I want to call out to Allah, I can say Ya Allah. But if I want to call out to Ahmad or Muhammad, I say Ya Muhammad, Ya Ahmad. If I want to call out to Zainab, I say Ya Zainab. But another way to call out to Allah is put a meme at the end of the name of Allah. Allahumma. Allahumma. Then if I want to call out to Muhammad, can I say Muhammadumma? If I want to call out to Zainab, can I say Zainabumma? No, I cannot. As not found in the Arabic language. And this is the fascinating thing. Even in pre-Islamic Arabic poetry, pre-Islamic Jahili poetry, pre-Islamic Arabic poetry, even then, before Islam, we see that the Arabs would use the phrase Allahumma. when talking about God, when talking about Allah. But the Arabs would never use the phrase, would never add that meme to the end of anyone else's name. No Zaydumma, Zainabumma. They would not do that. That is unique and specific only and only and only to the name of Allah. So a function in the language that is unique and special to the name of Allah, that another is another piece of evidence. There's even a fifth thing. And the fifth thing is just the usage of the word Allah across the board, across the spectrum in the Arabic language. That even those people who speak Arabic, their native tongue is Arabic, but they don't even necessarily believe in Islam. They are, you know, they believe in other faiths. They still refer to God, the divine, by calling Him Allah. And sixth and finally, we even find some historical evidence of even other faiths, non-Arab other faiths, pre-Islamically, using a word that was very similar in its pronunciation to the word Allah, Elohim, Allahumma. When you put all of this together, at least I personally feel, my teachers felt the same way, and many classical scholars also feel that the name of Allah is a unique word, a unique original word that is the name of Allah, the name of the Divine, and not necessarily a derivative. Having said that, aside from just research or maybe intellectually being, you know, somewhat stimulating, what is the practical benefit and purpose of this conversation? The practical benefit and implication of this conversation or this discussion is, then how do we translate the name of Allah? See, it's all about translation. If we understand the name of Allah, if we understand the name of Allah to be a derivative, it could have a different translation. But if we come to the conclusion, like we're saying here in this class at least, that the name of Allah is an original, unique name of the Divine, of Allah, then the translation of Allah, Allah in English will still be Allah. So when we use the word God to help facilitate understanding, I'm not saying that that's wrong. But at the same time, what I am saying is God will not be the translation of Allah. There's a difference between expressing the same idea, communicating that meaning, and saying something is a translation. There's a difference. God will not be a translation of Allah, but will be just the expression of that idea. But the translation of Allah, meaning Allah in the English language, will still be Allah. Abdurrahman. How do you translate Abdurrahman? How do you say Abdurrahman in English? Slave of the Most Merciful? No, you don't. Is that what you call your cousin Abdurrahman? No, of course you don't. Abdurrahman in English is? That's right. It's Abdurrahman. Abdurrahman is Abdurrahman. That's what it is, right? Names are exactly that. So names are just simply, that's their fix in that sense. So the translation of Allah will be Allah. All right, the next word is Akbar. Akbar in the Arabic language comes from the root word, which means for something to be great or something to be big. And what's very interesting is normally the translation that we see for Allahu Akbar is Allah is the greatest. But the word Akbar is the comparative, not the superlative. Akbar is the comparative, not the superlative. For anyone who did not understand, your college education is a waste. So for anyone who did not understand, I'll help, I'll explain. Don't worry, I'm from Texas, all right? I have no idea what these words mean either. The comparative means greater. Akbar is the comparative, greater. It is not the superlative, greatest. Zayd is faster than Khalid, but Ahmed is the fastest. Comparative, superlative. Akbar is the comparative, not the superlative. So what that means is Allahu Akbar means Allah is greater. But that's like me saying Zayd is faster than... I'm not saying anything else. That's problematic. You didn't finish the thought. You left me hanging there. That's the idea. There's a blank. Allahu Akbar, Allah is greater than blank. It's left open-ended on purpose. This is very commonly done in the Arabic language, very commonly found in the Quran, that when a statement demands an object and that object is not provided, it is not done so on purpose. And what it does is, the reason why it's left open-ended, it's so that the reader, the listener, the person reflecting on this, can customize the message to him or herself. We can plug in that blank for ourselves. Allah is greater than whatever is distracting me from my prayer at this very moment. So if the phone is ringing, Allahu Akbar means Allah is greater than that phone call. If the game is on, Allah is greater than that game. If somebody's waiting outside for me, Allah is greater than that person waiting for me. Allahu Akbar, Allah is greater, more important than whatever it is that is distracting me from my prayer at this very moment. That is simply just the meaning, the reflection, the khushu', if you will, that is built into these two simple, small little words that we have said our entire lives, that repeat itself throughout the prayer, that we start our prayer with. So we begin our prayer not just by saying a phrase that we memorized when we were 3 years old. We start our prayer by saying Allahu Akbar, by telling ourselves, convincing ourselves, pounding in the fact that Allah is greater, Allah is more important than whatever it may be that is calling for my attention right now. Allah is more important, Allah is greater. Allah takes precedence over everything and anything. Allahu Akbar. Think about when you even begin your prayer like that. The impact that it would have on you. Think about how long it would take to just say Allahu Akbar now. Normally it's just sort of like, Allahu Akbar. It's like that's a formality. I just got to get done with it. And then the real salah begins. No. Allahu Akbar. There's even thought built into that. See, this is where khushu' comes from. Very practical approach to khushu'. This is the goal and the objective. Practical spirituality. It's a little bit of a side note. A little bit of a rant. But we have a problem with how we approach spirituality today. There are two extremes when we approach spirituality. Either there is the extreme of it is something that is just so out of this universe, metaphysical, you know, very just everything allegorical, metaphysical, metaphorical. It's like, I don't even know what we're talking about anymore. I'm a country bumpkin from Texas. I have no idea what we're talking about anymore. So it just becomes this very bizarre, out of this world universe, mind-blowing conversation. And it's like, it's not practical. There's nothing practical about it. The other extreme to spirituality is a lot of times some people think that spirituality is basically just like this one huge, humongous guilt trip. We are filthy. We are dirty. We are sinful. We are garbage. We are trash. We are vermin. We are rodents. It's like, what's going on here? Allah said, وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي أَحْسَنِ تَقْوِيمٍ. And you just keep going on and on about what kind of like insect you are. Like, speak for yourself, right? Like, it's this guilt trip where it creates this unrealistic, unattainable, impractical standard of spirituality that just demoralizes more people than it inspires. Those are the two conversations that are predominant about spirituality today in the community. And it's problematic. It's killing people, spiritually speaking. So we need practical spirituality. And there is no form of spirituality that is more practical than salah, than prayer. Have a conversation with Allah. And tell me if it helps you feel more spiritual or not. Know what you're actually saying to Allah. And tell me if it helps your spiritual condition or not. Practical spirituality. That's what we're talking about here. So once we say takbir, we say Allahu Akbar, we enter into the prayer. Now what we have is what we call the opening supplications. I'm going to take a real quick pause here and tell y'all a little bit about the class. I kind of wait till an hour or two into the class to actually share some of this, just so that you know, everyone who's planning to get here gets here, everyone kind of gets settled in. Let me tell you a little bit about the class materials, how it's structured, how it's organized. So the subject and the topic of the class is the understanding, the depth, the beauty, the significance, the reflections of what we say and what we read in the prayer. There are many different things that we can study about the salah. One of the most prominent things that we can focus or learn about the salah is the fiqh of the prayer, the structure of the salah. I'm going to tell you all something. This is a philosophy in Islam, and my approach to all of our work, everything, every project that I'm involved in, I have one primary philosophy that I operate based off of, and that is quality over quantity. Quality over, I'm not worried about completing this much material. I don't care if we complete half of it or a third of it or a fourth of it. Those who have been in my classes know that, right? At the summer intensive, they showed up. There's this whole syllabus and daily lesson plan, everything laid out. We were running about 3 days behind it. But that was okay, because we needed to understand what we did cover. There was no point in me just blowing through stuff. There's no benefit to that. So quality over quantity. We have one weekend here that we have dedicated to our prayers. And we can do one of two things. We can cover the meaning of what we say in the prayer thoroughly in depth, which you got a taste of last night with Surah Fatiha. Or we can talk about the fiqh of the prayer. But if we try to do both, we'll actually end up achieving neither. We'll accomplish neither. So there's no benefit to that. There's no khair to that. So this weekend in particular is dedicated to studying the meaning of what we say in the prayer. It's not a disregard for fiqh. I studied fiqh for much of my life. I teach fiqh today to my own students. So this fiqh is a necessity, but so is this. And at least in my own personal experience, this is something that just is not being addressed. I personally, when I started researching this material, I couldn't find any thoroughly researched material on this. And so it's very much a need to be addressed. And so that's what we're going to be addressing this weekend. Time doesn't allow for us to get in. So if you're hoping that I'll touch on the fiqh of this or fiqh of that, we just don't have the time. You'll see that how we'll barely get done with the material. I'll probably end up even keeping y'all a little bit longer tonight. Not a lot, don't worry. Okay? So, but that's the time constraint we have. So therefore, for anybody who's got any questions in regards to class material, excellent. Anyone who's got any fiqh-related questions, I won't take them in the actual class. I understand if you do have a question that maybe you haven't had answered or you would like answered, right? Then during breaks, before, after class, I'll make myself available as much as possible. But keep those questions for outside of class timings, inshallah. So that's one request that I had. The second thing is that now we know what the subject matter of the class is. How is the class material organized? So the way we're going to go about in doing this, this is a great example of what you're looking at right now. There's an Arabic supplication that we're going to do. So what I'll do is I'll read the Arabic of the supplication. Underneath the Arabic supplication, you will see a translation. Notice the very specific word, the wording, a translation. Not my translation, but a translation. It is copy-pasted from either a translation of the Qur'an or a translation of just the sayings and prayers. Hisn al-Muslim, Fortress of the Muslim, just copy-pasted. So the purpose of that is just so you have something to compare and contrast with. And then you have this whole breakdown like a chart where I will give you the meaning of every single word specifically, word analysis. The purpose will not be to refute or to completely confirm the translation, but translation's there. It's a very good effort by somebody who tried to make their best effort. Translation's very difficult. It's the effort to try to express the meaning of something in as few words as possible. It's very challenging. So they've done an admirable job. But when we actually get to sit down and in-depth discuss the meaning of every word, of course it'll add something to our understanding of that. So that's how we're going to go about in covering the material. The next thing I want to tell you about just how the material is laid out over the 2 days, what I always like to tell students is Saturday is the work day, Sunday is the fun day. Now everyone's saying I came the wrong day. No. Sunday is more fun because of everything we've covered on Saturday. Meaning what? By the time we're done with today's material, inshallah, we will have covered at least 2/3 of all the vocabulary of the salah, of the prayer. We'll be through it. And that'll make Sunday flow a lot quicker, a lot faster, a lot easier, a lot smoother, inshallah. All right? And the specific thing I wanted to tell you was, this next section that we're starting now, opening supplications, this is the most vocabulary heavy section and portion of the entire course. A third of all the vocabulary of the prayer is contained in this little section right here. So if y'all can really buckle down, get serious, and get through this part of it, you'll be fine, you'll be good for the rest of it, inshallah. So I really need everyone to buckle down, inshallah, focus, and really get through this, inshallah. The last thing that I wanted to mention here, just kind of about the, the layout of the class material and the layout of the class, was, I forgot. All right. So we talked about the material, the distribution of the material, the layout in terms of the handout, and also the vocabulary that we're going to be covering. Yes, the final thing I want to mention to you is this. To be very frank and very honest with you, the amount of information that we're going to cover in this one weekend, it's huge. We're going to be covering a lot in one weekend. In a more traditional, classical format of ilm, of knowledge, this much material would be covered over weeks, if not months. That's just very honest. But we cram it and squeeze it into one weekend because of our circumstances, because of our situation. Everyone's got limited time. Everyone's got a dozen different things going on. So we kind of, everybody frees themselves up for one weekend. I came up, y'all took out time, y'all came out, and we sit down and we get done. We plow through it in one weekend. But that creates a few challenges. Number one, it creates a challenge of retention. How do you retain everything that you learned? So number one, the first thing about retaining what you learn, it not only will help you retain, but will also help you to kind of pay attention and stay focused in the class, and that is interaction. You got to interact in the class. And a big part of that interaction will be repetition. I'll make you tell me the answer to something, or I'll have you repeat the meaning of something. That might seem a little demeaning to someone. It's not. It's called ta'aleem wa ta'allum, teaching and learning. It's a part of being a student of knowledge. Secondly, a lot of times, for a lot of folks, when they come to a class like this, they haven't been in a classroom for a very long time. So it's kind of getting reacquainted with being a student, and there's even a little bit of discomfort a lot of times in kind of that student mode and responding and taking part in the class. Don't let that be a problem. You need to take part for your own benefit so that you can learn and retain the material. The second thing about retention is that review will be very important, which is something I'll talk to y'all more about tomorrow. At the conclusion of the material, I'm actually going to pass on some tips on how to review this, how to implement this, so that it becomes something that is very second nature, very intuitive, very automatic for you, inshallah. Very practical and beneficial, inshallah. All right, now that we got that out of the way, let's get started with the first opening supplication. I'm going to read the Arabic. Allahumma ba'id bayni wa bayna khatayaya kama ba'adta bayna al-mashriqi wal-maghrib. Allahumma naqqini min khatayaya kama yunaqqa thawb al-abyadu min al-danas. Allahumma ghsilni min khatayaya بالماء والثلج والبرد. Now let's do the word analysis. Allahumma. Allahumma means what, everyone? Oh Allah, Ya Allah. Let me tell you the difference between Ya Allah and Allahumma. If Ya Allah would translate as Oh Allah, if Allahumma translates as Oh Allah, then what's the difference? Potato, potato? No, there is a difference. If it looks different, sounds different, it is different. What is the difference? You know when you say Ya Allah, you're using Ya to call out to Allah. What if I want to call out to Zayd or Khalid or Zainab or Fatima? What would I say? I would say Ya Khalid, Ya Zayd, Ya Fatima, Ya Aisha. I would say Ya. That's as simple and as easy as it is. It's common. So saying Ya Allah, you are calling out to Allah, but there's nothing unique about it. But when you say Allahumma, can you call out to anyone else by putting a meme on their name? No, you cannot. So now you are calling out to Allah, you are speaking to Allah in a way that is unique to Allah. Therefore, it is more powerful, more emphatic, more special. So Allahumma is more powerful than Ya Allah. Allahumma is more powerful than Ya Allah because it's unique and special to Allah. The next word is ba'id. Ba'id. This comes from the root word bu'd. Bu'd in the Arabic language means for something to be far, something to be distant. The antonym, the opposite of qurb, closeness, bu'd, far. Secondly, this word ba'id is the command form. The command form. We're talking to Allah using the imperative, the command form. But what we should keep in mind is, you know, that's why in classical books of grammar, fi'lul amr, the command, the imperative form is called fi'lul amri wa talab. It is not only for commanding, it is also for requesting. So when you talk to someone that is superior to you and you use the command form, you're not saying, do this. You're saying, please, I request this. Please do this for me. There's a difference. So now it's a command form. Thirdly, ba'id is a more evolved, sophisticated form of the word. And this more evolved form of the word, it has the meaning of mubalagha, hyperbole built into it. So it doesn't just mean distance, it means a huge amount of distance. So put everything together, Allahumma ba'id means, oh Allah, please put a huge amount of distance. Oh Allah, please put a huge distance. Where? Bayni. Take a look at this word, bayni. This is gonna. This might be something somebody here already knows, but otherwise, it shows us something about the Arabic language. In the English language, how do you know one word has ended, another word has started? How do you know that? How do you tell that? A space. Very good. A space. Bayni, based off of an English perspective, how many words does bayni look like? One word. In reality, those who know, please tell us, how many words is it actually? Two words. That's something about the Arabic language, it's two words. A space is not necessary between words. Bayni, two words. Bayna means between, clearly between. That's why mubin, bayan, bayinat, all of these words come from the same root. Clarity is at the root of it. Clear speech, clear proof, clear evidence. Self-clarifying, self-evident. So bayna means clearly between. E means me. Oh Allah, put a huge amount of distance. Bayni, clearly between me. Wa bayna, and clearly between. Khataya ya. Khataya ya. That is two words. The first word is khataya, and the second word is ya. What is the meaning of these two different words? The word khataya is the plural of the word khati'atun. It's the plural of the word khati'atun. The word khati'a in the Arabic language comes from the root word khata. Khata in the Arabic language, khati'a, this is the singular, comes from the root word khata. Khata in the Arabic language means a mistake, a slip, like a slip up, an error. Not a sin, but a mistake, like a slip up, an error. That's why when an archer shoots his arrow, takes his time, you know, pulls it back, eyeballs it, makes sure everything's good, lines it up, and then releases it, and then just by accident, misses the target, that's called khata. That's called khata. It's a mistake, it's a slip up, it's an error, not a sin. Sin implies somebody's doing something wrong, they know it's wrong and they're still doing it. They know what they're doing, they know that it's wrong, but they still do it. A khata is one of two things. A khata would be number one, so if I'm walking around with this cup and it's got a hole in it and it's leaking, I don't know that though, I'm walking around with it and it's leaking. Somebody says, what are you doing? Why are you making a mess? I said, what are you talking about? It's leaking. Oh, I didn't even know. I didn't realize. So I did not, it's wrong what I'm doing, but I didn't know that that's what I was doing. The second example of a khata would be that, let's just say I get my lunch and I go into the prayer room and I sit down in the prayer room and I'm eating my lunch. But the problem is that there's a rule, there's a regulation, no food in the prayer room. No food in the musalla. So now, what ends up happening is, I know what I'm doing. I just didn't know that it was wrong. I didn't know that it wasn't allowed. That's a khata. So that's the meaning of this word. Why is the Prophet ﷺ in this dua using the word for mistake? Khataya is mistakes. Ya means my. Oh Allah, Allahumma ba'id. Oh Allah, put a huge amount of distance clearly between me and clearly between my mistakes, my slip-ups, my errors. Why is Allah using the word for mistakes or slip-up, or why are we rather in this dua using the word for mistakes rather than sins? Why? Because this is inclusive of sins, but it's more than sins. What we're saying here is, oh Allah, remove from me, take away from me, put a huge distance between me and not just my sins, but even those things that I've done that I don't even realize that I've done. Even my small little mistakes and slip-ups and errors that I'm not even conscious of or aware of, take them away from me. The next word is kama. Kama in the Arabic language means just like. It's used to draw a parallel, to make a comparison. Just like ba'atta. Ba'atta is the past tense of the word ba'id. Ba'atta means just like you have placed a huge distance. Baina, between, clearly between, al-mashriq wal-maghrib. Al-mashriq in the Arabic language means the east. Like the direction, the east. But it comes from the root word sharq, which means to fill with light. وَأَشْرَقَتِ الْأَرْضُ بِنُورِ رَبِّهَا. The earth became filled with light by the nur of its Lord and its Master. It became illuminated through the nur, the light of its Lord and its Master. So it means to fill with light. Why would the word for east come from the root word which means to fill with light? Because sun rises in the east. Very simple. The next word is al-maghrib. Al-maghrib means the west. It comes from the root word gharb. Gharb in the Arabic language means to vanish, to disappear. Why would the word for west come from the root word which means to vanish or disappear? Because the sun sets in the west. Very logical again. Very logical. This has some interesting derivatives that are found in the Arabic language, in classical Arabic in particular. Gharib. Gharib. And no, Desi people, it does not mean a poor person. Okay? The word gharib means stranger. Stranger danger. Right? That's what I teach my kids. Gharib. Gharib means a stranger. Why would it come from the root word which means to vanish? Because it's like this guy materialized out of thin air. He came out of nowhere. And when he leaves again, it's like he just disappeared. He was here today, gone tomorrow. We don't know where he came from. We don't know where he went. Just boom. Drifter, wanderer, wafer, stranger. Came out of nowhere and disappeared into thin air. And then think for a minute about the fact the Prophet ﷺ told us to live in the world like that. Very interesting. Similarly, the word ghurab means a crow, like the black bird, crow. This is very fascinating to a nerd like myself. Why would the Arabs give the name to a crow that comes from the root word which means to vanish, disappear? See, the thing about the Arabs, the pre-Islamic Arabs, just like any other people who don't have a proper belief system, they tend to be very superstitious people. And the crow has always been the fascination and the object of much superstition. So because the crow is a carrion bird, it eats, you know, dead animals, they associated the crow with being bad news. If they would see a bunch of crows, they would think they bring death. It's like an evil omen. It's an omen of death coming. And so that's what they believed. It's false and correct. But then because of that, they just called the hurab. They called the crow hurab, hurab, which meant go away, go away. Disappear, disappear, leave, go away, vanish. Trying to make it leave and repel the evil that it comes with. Very interesting. All right? There's one other derivative that I hesitate to share. Istaghraba, istighrab, istaghraba. Which basically means that, you know when somebody says something that's like really uncomfortable and awkward? When somebody says something that's really uncomfortable and awkward, they would say istaghraba ar-rajulu. Because you basically wish that person would go away. Right? So that's a phrase that the Arabs would have. Istaghraba ar-rajulu. When somebody would say something very awkward, when somebody would say something very uncomfortable, they would say istaghraba ar-rajulu. I wish that person would just go away. I wish he would just disappear. He would just vanish. It's a very interesting word. Al-Maghrib, the West, called that because the sun sets in the west, it disappears, it goes away. Now let's put these two lines together. And we get something interesting. The Prophet of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam is teaching us the dua, oh Allah, put a huge amount of distance clearly between me and any even little itty bitty mistakes I may have made that I'm not even aware or conscious of. I don't even realize I've made those mistakes. Put a huge amount of distance between me and all of those mistakes. Remove them from me. Just like the huge amount of distance that you have placed between the east and the west. Now, y'all might not have a really good appreciation for what the imagery here is. Because the east and the west is basically this building and that building. All right? But I want you to imagine being somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Like Oklahoma. All right? So imagine, and really seriously, I used to drive through Oklahoma a lot. And over there, there are parts of it. It's actually very beautiful and very fascinating in its own way. There are places where you're just driving on the freeway and you just stop your car in the middle of the freeway because nobody's there. So you just stop your car, you just park your car in the middle of the freeway and you get out and you go and you stand out in the open and you look to the east and you can literally see for miles on end. Miles away you can see. Just standing there. You look to the west and you can see for miles and miles and miles. So imagine the desert, standing out there in the middle of nowhere, looking off into the east and being able to see miles and miles away. Looking into the west and being able to see miles off into the distance. And then thinking to yourself, think about the huge amount of distance all the way from the easternmost point where your eyes can see to the westernmost point that your eyes can see. And what a huge amount of distance that is. And then saying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, oh Allah, put even a greater distance between me and all the mistakes and sins I've ever committed. Take them that far away from me. Remove them from me completely. كَمَا بَعَدْتَ بَيْنَ الْمَشْرِقِ وَالْمَغْرِبِ Then the dua continues. Allahumma, O Allah, نَقِّنِي نَقِّنِي This word نَقِّي in the Arabic language just comes from the root word which means to scrape, to remove, to brush off, to scrape off. نِي means me. O Allah, remove from me, scrub off from me, brush away from me. Remove what from me? Min means from. Khatayaya, my mistakes, my errors, my slip-ups. Scrub and brush and scrape them off of me. Kema, once again, just like. Yunaqqa, yunaqqa is the passive form. Just like it is scrubbed, it is brushed, it is removed. What is it being removed from? A thawb. Thawb in the Arabic language means clothes. The next word is al-abyad. Abyad in the Arabic language means white. Anybody know another word that kind of sounds like abyad, comes from the same root? Bayda. Bayda means egg. Why? Because eggs are white. Okay, hippies? Nobody wants to eat your brown eggs, all right? Eggs are white. So, al-abyad means white. Al-thawb al-abyad means white clothes. Just like white clothes are scrubbed and brushed and scraped and cleansed. What is being scrubbed and brushed out of that white clothes? Min ad-danas. Min means from. Ad-danas. Ad-danas in the Arabic language means something that you spill, something that you drop, something that you spill, and it leaves a stain. Something that you drop, something you spill, and it leaves a stain. Basically, all variations of desi food. All right? No, and seriously, like if you spill some water, does it leave a stain? No. Drop some breadcrumbs, doesn't leave a stain. But something that you eat, like, so ketchup, right? You drop some ketchup on your shirt, leaves a stain. So now, put it together, what is going on here? Now we're saying, oh Allah, you've removed my mistakes and my sins away from me. But oh Allah, after removing them away from me, now scrub and brush the leftover stain, the after effects, the stain that remains behind, scrub and brush that off of me, away from me, from me. Just like if you spill something on a white shirt. How you have to scrub and brush and try to get that stain out of a white shirt. Look at the imagery the Prophet ﷺ provides and look how practical it is. You ever worn like a brand new, amazing white shirt? Right, it's Jumu'ah, Friday. You put on this baller white shirt. It's so amazing, it's shiny. Right, it's amazing. So you put on this baller, brand new white shirt. Go to Jumu'ah. Even at Jumu'ah, everyone's like, dang, that's amazing. Mashallah, right? And when you get done with Jumu'ah, you go to lunch with some of the folks. And while you're at lunch, you spill ketchup on your white shirt. And you go into panic mode, emergency mode, right? You forget about your food and everything. It's a panic mode, right? Go to the bathroom, you're trying to clean it up, scrape it up, put some soap on it, Tide stick, right? You're doing whatever you can, try to get out that stain. You're freaked out. You spend the next 15, 20 minutes trying to clean up that white, that ketchup stain off that white shirt. When you get done doing everything, what can you still see there? You can still see that stain. You can still see that little red spot. And for the rest of the day, what does that stain do? It mocks you. It makes fun of you. Every time you look in the mirror, you can hear the stain laughing at you. Right? You can hear the stain laughing at you. Whenever you meet anyone for the rest of the day, it's like, Assalamualaikum, how's it going? Oh my God, what happened to your shirt? What happened to your face, dude? Right? Don't talk. You're like all sensitive about your stain on your white shirt. You're like bothered by it. Right? So think about just the level of like disturbance that a stain would cause on a white shirt, on white clothes. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam is connecting that same type of idea, practical, right? Practical spirituality. Connecting that idea that when I commit a sin, when I make a mistake, when I slip up, when I disobey Allah, I asked Allah to remove that from me, but I got to be, number one, be conscious of the fact that when the sin or the mistake is removed from me, it leaves a stain behind. I got to get that stain out, and I got to be concerned and worried and bothered by that stain, just like I would be bothered by a stain on a white shirt. The third step. So we remove it, we wash it, or we scrub it actually. We remove it, we scrub it. The third step of the process is to now wash it, rinse it, wash it out. Allahumma ighsilni. Oh Allah, ighsilni. Ighsilni is two words. The first word is ighsil, ghasala, which means to wash. Ni means me. Oh Allah, wash me, cleanse me, wash me. Min, from. Khatayaya, my mistakes, my errors, my slip-ups. Bilma'i, that's two words. The first word is the letter ba. Ba means with, using. Alma means water. With water, using water. The next two words are athalj. Thalj in the Arabic language. Okay, let's see. Anybody who natively speaks Arabic, in modern Arabic, thalj means what, everyone? Ice. Some people said ice. Okay, very good. In classical Arabic, it means snow. In classical Arabic, it means snow. And the third word there is al-barad. Pronunciation is very specific. I'm not saying bard. Bard means cold. But barad, with a fatha on the ra, in classical Arabic means ice. It means ice. That which is the coldest thing possible, which is ice. So, O Allah, wash me from my mistakes, my slip-ups, my errors, including my sins, with water and snow and ice. This is completing that cleansing process that now you got to wash it out, you got to rinse it out. Now, the obvious question everyone's got on their mind is, what's this water, snow, and ice business? Why is he talking about this? Where did this come into the conversation from? Water, I get, very logical, but what about snow and ice? This is the eloquence of the Prophet ﷺ on full display. This is balagha at its best. See, the Prophet of Allah ﷺ mentioned two more things, snow and ice. But in that very subtly, he told us something very powerful, very profound. That, think about this. If we make mistakes, we commit sins, and we're not forgiven for them, where could they lead us? Into the fire of hell, punishment, fire of hell. And the more severe the sins or the mistakes, the more severe the fire. Well, what can put out the fire? Water. But if it's more severe, intense, the fire, because of the more severity of the sins, then we would need something colder than water to put out that fire, and that would be snow. More severe sins, more severe, intense heat and fire, something colder than snow is ice. The Prophet of Allah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam just mentioning, dropping the word snow and ice reminds us of the consequences of our deeds, what the outcome could be, and also it's very subtly worked in the fact that, oh Allah, maybe I might have made bigger mistakes. If I've made bigger mistakes, I need greater forgiveness from you, a greater cleansing from you with water and snow and ice. The last thing, very subtle. If anybody has any experience with this, if you do get a stain on white clothing, on a white shirt, for instance, if you get a stain on there, what kind of water should you wash it in? Cold water. A bunch of the youngins are like, Mom, right? That's not a temperature of water, all right? It's cold water, right? You wash it in cold water. Why do you do that? So that the stain doesn't burn, doesn't settle into the clothing. And subhanAllah, the Prophet ﷺ very subtly slipped that in. That's why he's talking about cold, cleansing agents. You see the depth and the wisdom and the eloquence of the Prophet ﷺ. So three things. Oh Allah, remove my mistakes from me, like the distance between the east and the west. Scrub and brush the stains of my mistakes from me, just like the stain on a white shirt. And oh Allah, wash me from my mistakes and my sins with water and snow and ice, whatever is needed in order to remove those mistakes from me and any consequences that could come about as a result from that. So a very comprehensive, beautiful dua and supplication from the Prophet ﷺ to begin the prayer. The theme and the summary of this dua is a complete cleansing of one's soul, purification and cleansing of one's heart, one's soul.